You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, everybody, and welcome back if you're rejoining us. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Well, there has been so much action going on in our court system and in the sphere of public debate about Donald Trump's deployment of, I don't know, National Guard from Texas and Illinois or California and Illinois and maybe some from California and Oregon and differing court decisions. And what does all of this mean in our democratic republic? Well, we've got a guest that's going to help us unpack all of this this afternoon. I've been very much looking forward to talk to him. His name is Josh Braver. He is an assistant professor of law at my alma mater, the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Welcome to the program, Josh. Thanks for making time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start at the beginning. I just want to refresh everybody's recollection. Donald Trump, when he addressed the room full of about 800 of our military top brass, as the phrase would be, basically said to them, we should be no problem deploying the military on our cities or in our cities. Let's take a listen to a short montage of Donald Trump making these statements, both at Quantico and in other circumstances. Take a listen.
Well, we're going in. I didn't say when. We're going in. When you lose, look, I have an obligation. This isn't a political thing. I have an obligation. If the governor of Illinois would call me up, I would love to do it. Now, we're going to do it anyway. We have the right to do it because I have an obligation to protect this country.
We're under invasion from within. No different than a foreign enemy, but more difficult in many ways because they don't wear uniforms. And I told Pete, we should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military, National Guard, but military.
Quite shocking. And this, just yesterday in the Oval Office about the invocation of the Insurrection Act. Take a listen.
We're going to make Chicago really great again, and we're going to stop this crime. Then we're going to go to another one, and we're going to go city by city. We're going to have safe cities.
The Insurrection Act, under what conditions or terms would you?
Well, I'd do it if it was necessary. So far, it hasn't been necessary. But we have an Insurrection Act for a reason. If I had to enact it, I'd do that. If people were being killed and courts were holding us up or governors or mayors were holding us up, sure, I'd do that.
And again, ahead of his remarks before our top brass at Quantico, Donald Trump threatened to fire some of our military generals. Listen to this.
So I'm going over. I'm going to be meeting with generals and with admirals and with leaders. And if I don't like somebody, I'm going to fire them right on the spot.
And of course, then before these very generals and top brass, basically said, if you don't like me, you can walk out, but there goes your career. And so take a listen to this last bit.
Never walked into a room so silent before. This is very, don't laugh. You're not allowed to do that. You know what? Just have a good time. And if you want to applaud, you applaud. And if you want to do anything you want, you can do anything you want. And if you don't like what I'm saying, you can leave the room. Of course, there goes your rank. There goes your future.
So Donald Trump, not known for being a guy that's real specific about what he's saying, Professor Braver. But what I wanted to do was just talk with you to begin before we get into these court cases and what might come next. And are we at a tipping point? Is why do we have civilian control of the military? And why is it that our constitutional structure requires, for example, Congress to declare war? Why is it that the president does not have plenary authority, as claimed by Stephen Miller on CNN earlier this week, over our military, over our National Guard? Why is it the case that governors generally are the ones to request intercession or assistance from the National Guard? Why are we structured like this?
We're a democracy, and the idea of a democracy is that we have civilian control of the military. How that control is divided up is a question about who's best on the ground, who knows best what's going on, are the situation dire or enough of an emergency to make this happen? And The idea about our military in terms of being deployed domestically, when the military is put on America's streets, is the long tradition has been that it should only be a last resort. It should only be when civilian law enforcement is completely or nearly completely incapable of enforcing the law. Think about riots like in 1991 in Los Angeles or in 1968. These are moments where civilian law enforcement really was completely and totally overwhelmed. It can't be just because an ICE agent is having some trouble enforcing immigration law. That's not enough. The reason why that exists is because our military, I'll say it's for two reasons. Our military are not trained in civilian law enforcement. They're not trained in crowd control. The mission of our military is to fight and win our nation's war. Their job is to kill people. For our police, they too might have to kill people, but that's an unfortunate necessity. That's a tragedy. That's something that should be tried to be avoided at all costs. And the second reason is that our military should remain non-partisan. It's very important that the military has the trust of both Republicans and both Democrats. And intervening in controversies about Black Lives Matter, about enforcement of immigration, other civilian law enforcement, it really sullies the military's reputation. It really associates them with one side in our nation's culture wars.
Folks, again, if you're just joining us, I have an expert on the civil-military relationship in our constitutional republic. He is Professor Josh Braver of UW Law School. You said something that I think is so important for all of us to remember. The military is supposed to be nonpartisan. It is supposed to be that to ensure that there is public trust in our military. And so that it, frankly, it is a bulwark against slipping into authoritarian dictatorships where a single party controls or a single elected official controls the military and uses it for their own personal political ends. We're seeing courts right now grappling with these factual allegations coming from the administration about unrest. You said the military, the National Guard, only used as a last resort when civil law enforcement is no longer capable of enforcing the law, when they are completely overrun. That is simply not what is happening in these cities. And you see courts grappling with this. And here's my question to you, Professor. To me, and I think to many folks who want to be clear-eyed about this, the fact that that set of predicate facts, overrun and completely incapable local law enforcement, that is not true. So what is making it so difficult for courts to acknowledge that and conclude that what the president has been doing is indeed illegal?
It's a fantastic question. Let me give you two answers. The first is that old habits die hard. You know, the courts have long existed in a world in which the presidency could be trusted to use its discretion, to use restraint. These categories about last resort, only when civil authorities have failed, they're part of long traditions within the executive branch, long-standing guidances, legal memos. And we're really in a new world where the Trump administration has systematically sidelined those offices, ignored those guidelines. And so all the reasons for the trust that legitimately existed before, you know, it's a very difficult situation for a court to be in where it's going to try and interfere with the president on these matters. And so it's a much easier world for the courts to have a president that is going to, for the most part, be within boundaries, and you can mostly stay out of the line of fire. That's the second reason, which is that we have grown up in a world in which we think of courts as being very powerful, but it is very easy for the president to defy courts. This is a problem that we really struggled with in the founding era. And so what courts would like to do is not to be put in a position where they're in a position where the president so prioritizes a certain policy that they'll just end up defying the court. Because the court's orders are not self-reinforcing. They rely on the president to comply out of its own will, right? The court has no police force, it has no army. That's the reason why the founding fathers said it was the least dangerous branch. And so they would rather try, on the most part, to only force the issue when it's absolutely necessary. But we are in a world where deference no longer makes sense, and we're getting very close to it being absolutely necessary. They keep trying half measures. The hope is that it will slow down Donald Trump until other actors can jump in who have more power, someone like Congress, someone like the governors. But there becomes a certain point in which their back is against the wall, and they're going to have to stand up and call a lie a lie, and that there's not a rebellion, that they are able to enforce the law.
I feel like each day, Professor, we inch closer and closer and closer to that point. I feel like collectively, as a constitutional republic, that we got closer to the point of, do we actually have open conflict between branches of government this week, when Attorney General Bondi refused to answer very basic questions about will you direct your Department of Justice and provide guidance to the White House that they absolutely must follow court orders even when they are under appeal. What was your, and we've got a smidge over a minute left, what was your reaction to the Attorney General, aside from what was clearly like the partisan rhetoric of that? And there was a lot of just theater that was happening there, if we're being candid. But at the root of this was her unwillingness to respond to legitimate congressional oversight and her unwillingness to answer the most fundamental question, which is the administration's obligation under our Constitution and oath that they all take to follow court orders.
If an administration doesn't follow court orders, we are in a constitutional crisis. And I don't use that term lightly. It's a term that's thrown around all the time. And right. We have constitutional conflicts all the time. But one clear marker of when we are in a crisis is when there is an open and flagrant violation of the Supreme Court's orders. And so far, the Trump administration has steered within barely the lines of following the letter, if not the spirit, of the Supreme Court's orders. And it's a little bit disturbing if the administration seems to be backing away from giving Congress those kinds of guarantees.
What about the lower court orders? There seems to be, frankly, open disdain for lower court orders that they do not agree with, and open flouting of those orders. Certainly, the Oregon judge's ruling, that was a Trump-appointed judge, and you know, just reading around the ruling, much to the ire of that judge.
Yeah, I think part of the issue, even though I think the lower court orders have been obeyed in general, the Supreme Court has been aggressively turning back those lower court orders for a variety of reasons. And so the authority of the lower courts have been undercut in some sense by the Supreme Court.
That in and of itself, the failure of our Supreme Court to support and empower the lower courts and to require the administration to follow those orders is worthy of note. We're going to talk about what this portends, what comes next. What comes next in Chicago, and maybe what's coming right here to Wisconsin. Folks, you're going to want to stay tuned. I'm with Professor Josh Braver, and this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. For the rest of this half hour, I continue our conversation with our special guest, Professor Josh Braver, an expert in the relationship between civil authorities and the military. He is an assistant professor of law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thanks for sticking around with us, Josh. Before the break, we were getting into the current moment and the fact that we've now got Texas National Guard in the Chicagoland area. We've got differing court orders from Illinois, a federal judge in Illinois, a federal judge in Oregon. We've got a Supreme Court that to date has not really supported the lower federal courts or required strict adherence of the Trump administration to lower courts' orders. And we seem to be at this inflection point. Literally, we've got armed soldiers from one state about to square off against protesters in another state whose governor doesn't want those National Guard members there, a president whose deputy chief of staff is complaining, is claiming absolute power to direct Guards members wherever he wants, despite the fact that that is not what the law says. How close are we to one of these constitutional sort of bright line tipping points? How dangerous is this moment? And really, how strong as a legal matter is the president's assertion that he can do whatever he wants with whatever state's National Guard?
I'll start with the second on the law. So the law here is very clear. It sets out three conditions under which you can nationalize the Guard. One is invasion. There's clearly no invasion here. The administration's not even claiming there's an invasion in their court cases. The second is rebellion. And the third is unable with the regular forces to execute the laws of the United States. I really don't think, I don't want to play down the levels of resistance to ICE agents, but calling this a rebellion is very far-fetched. You know, we've had things that maybe we've called rebellions in the past, the whiskey rebellion. This is where literally people are being tarred and feathered and they can't enter the city in any way. And George Washington has tried to send negotiators and they've been chased out and tarred and feathered. So the bar here is pretty high. And the president is unable with regular forces to execute the laws of the United States. You know, that means you have to try with the regular forces and they have to significantly fail. It can't just be that they're impeded or there's resistance, which happens every day to law enforcement. So as a matter of law, if you apply these criteria seriously, especially in a place like Portland, I mean, in Los Angeles, I don't want to play it down. There are people trying to seriously use physical force to enter the building. They're trapping ICE agents in cars. There are Molotov cocktails. I still don't think that's a rebellion. I still don't think it meets the criteria. But in Portland, it's people basically milling around. And insofar as they get rowdy, police officers are arresting them and taking them off the territory. So there's just no real plausible case that in Portland you have the criteria necessary for the president to federalize the Guard.
All of this leads me to the question about the Insurrection Act and what the law there is. In my opinion, and based on conversations with folks like yourself, it is very clear that the legal prerequisites to the president's deployment of the National Guard against civilian protesters has not been met. I think it's debatable in LA, given the geographic scope and the fact that it was a very small proportion of the protesters, but it's not met in Chicago. It's clearly not met in Portland. It clearly isn't going to be met in Milwaukee or other places. The fact that the president has deployed these forces exclusively in Democratic-leaning cities, and his now promise or the guise of all of this being about immigration enforcement and his promise that, oh yeah, if I think it's necessary, I'll invoke the Insurrection Act. What is the Insurrection Act for? And does it have anything to do with immigration enforcement at all?
The Insurrection Act is a way that we've been talking about federalizing the National Guard in these cities. That was the statute I was talking about earlier.
Yes.
The Insurrection Act is about sending in the army itself. The Marines, the active duty soldiers whose normal job day to day are professionals in fighting wars. And so that's the distinction between the Insurrection Act and the other statute. The Insurrection Act is written very broadly. It is written in ways that can be interpreted as giving the president a great deal of discretion to send them in for obstructing or impeding the execution of the laws. But it's never been used that way. It would be a serious violation of precedent. And the executive branch as a whole, its lawyers, have opinion upon opinion piled up saying, you cannot use this recklessly. We have to really think about what its intention was, what its context was, and what the precedents are. And the precedents are clearly things like, as I was mentioning before, riots in which the police can no longer handle it. Places where entire areas of the city are being shut off. Think about the Seattle Autonomous Zone and think about it if it had been done where the Seattle police had really tried to move in rather than wait a few days and then moved in and cleared it out, right? Maybe they tried to move in again and again and couldn't do it. That's just not what we have. And so the president is pushing the law to the limit on the Insurrection Act, interpreting it in ways that it's maybe could be plausible by its text, but goes way beyond what presidents and Department of Justice lawyers have long advised exactly not to do.
If the president invokes the Insurrection Act under facts similar to substantially current facts, do we have a constitutional crisis?
I think we have a crisis for the military. I think we have a crisis in civil-military relations, that we are at risk of discrediting a force that we need to protect ourselves against foreign adversaries. And without a good military, we're in real trouble.
Folks, he'll be back again, I certainly hope. Professor Josh Braver of the University of Wisconsin Law School. We continue to discuss this topic, what it means if the National Guard shows up on the streets of Milwaukee or Madison next. Join us, 855-752-4842. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Problem is not all inside your head. It is happening in real time, folks. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Big thanks to Professor Josh Braver of the University of Wisconsin Law School, helping us understand the relationship and why we have civil leadership of our military and the fact that we may be approaching inch by inch quite a constitutional crisis. In Professor Braver's words, the military, the National Guard, should only be used as an absolute last resort when civil law enforcement is incapable of enforcing the law. We simply do not have those facts on the ground in Portland or in Chicago, and certainly not here in Milwaukee. We're going to get into some of the lies that are being told by the administration about the factual circumstances. This matters. It matters a lot, because if we're going to have any fidelity to our system of laws, if we expect presidents to follow the law, especially when it's not a president that you agree with, then an administration's willingness to lie about the facts that either trigger certain presidential powers or don't, we need to be really concerned about that. So I want to get into that, but in the realm of, oh my gosh, what is even happening? Excuse me. We have the head of the Department of Health and Human Services, that RFK Jr., saying a bunch more pretty crazy things recently. Yesterday, RFK Jr., basically, again, this is becoming more and more prevalent, admitted the quiet part out loud about the litmus testing of scientists within the Department of Health and Human Services. Take a listen to what he said about, proving or studying some of these wild claims that RFK makes. Take a listen.
Studies that show the countries that use the most have the highest level of autism. Cuba has the lowest level in the world of acetaminophen use, and it has the lowest autism rate in the world. So this is not dispositive. It is not proof. We're doing the studies to make the proof.
Oops. Wait. What was that? You're doing the studies to prove your hypothesis that acetaminophen or Tylenol causes autism. By the way, maybe RFK, maybe it might be the case that Cuba has really low rates of autism because they don't have the state-of-the-art medical system there, and they're probably way underdiagnosing it. I don't know. Their cars are still from the 1960s. I'm sure their medicine is state-of-the-art. If you're using Cuba as an example, probably on some fairly thin ice. I don't know, just me. As if that was not, telling enough about the fact that, we'll get the proof. We'll make sure that the studies give us the proof of my hypothesis about the Tylenol. Somehow we have now, RFK is now linking circumcision, Tylenol, and autism. I wish I was making it up, but I'm not. Take a listen to this from today's cabinet meeting. Ooh. There's an ad playing. Okay, we've got to wait just a second to get to that sound. We'll have it for you in a second. Again, this was in this morning's cabinet meeting, which is pretty wild. Let me know when we've got that sound, because again, we're linking together somehow autism, circumcision, and Tylenol. Take a listen.
There's many other confirmation studies. There's two studies that show children who are circumcised early have double the rate of autism. And it's highly likely because they're given Tylenol. So, you know, none of this is positive, but all of it is stuff that we should be paying attention to.
Yeah.
But, you know.
I wish RFK actually knew something about medicine and how science works. I wish he did. I really did. Because he apparently does not understand the difference between correlation and causation and the difference between what are effectively selective case study reviews and the difference between a single study that might be a case study review and actual scientific method-based longitudinal studies with time series and cross-sectional data. And if you don't know what any of that is, it's okay. But it's the difference between basically making stuff up out of thin air or a one-off example that's never really been studied at any depth and actual data-driven analysis. And RFK Jr. doesn't know the difference. And all they seem to be paying attention to, it's like the maximum level of confirmation bias. All he pays attention to is the stuff that confirm his preordained wackadoodle conspiracy theories. This is not how medicine should be practiced, ladies and gentlemen. But that's who we've got running DHHS. 855-752-4842, 855-75-CIVIC. Jack from Merrimack, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, well, first of all, this is part of Project 2025, which basically says that all the results of all studies and regulations and other information has predetermined, and we're going to tell you how what it's supposed to be. I mean, that's exactly what it is. But I don't know if I mentioned this on your show or not, but there's a historian by the name of Hannah Arendt, and she really hits the nail on the head with what this is all about. And she basically says several things about lying and authoritative regimes. And one of them is the purpose of lying is not to make everybody believe the lie. The purpose of lying is to confuse the matters so that nobody knows what to believe anymore. And the second thing, and this is what's really critical, is that people who don't know fact from fiction, truth from lies, don't know right from wrong, and they are the ideal subject for authoritarian rule. It doesn't make any difference if it's fascism or communism, but the ideal subject is somebody that really doesn't know what to believe anymore.
I couldn't thank you so much for that reminder, Jack. And the reason that I folded this RFK nonsense in here, before we get into this longer conversation about the lying that is coming out of ICE and the Department of Homeland Security every day, is precisely this. When on every conceivable front, you have federal government high-ranking officials that are willing to lie and distort the truth. It's not that I think the vast majority of Americans are like, oh yeah, circumcision, .. autism. No. It's precisely what Jack is talking about. It opens up this area where people who want to believe in Donald Trump, want to believe that he actually has their best interest in heart, can say, well, we don't know that that's true, or I'm going to believe this. And it has this overwhelming impact of making the truth outside of our collective knowability. We don't know what the facts are, so anything's fine. It weakens institutions. It erodes public trust. And when you have that, when you have a circumstance where, because of the confirmation bias machines that we call our cell phones, our mobile phones, our smartphones, vast swaths, tens of millions of people think that Tylenol causes autism, that circumcisions cause autism, that RFK actually has some reasonable grasp of how science and medicine is practiced. And when all of that generically leads to this overwhelming mistrust, it becomes much, much easier for a single person to stand up supported by a party of sycophants and a failing legislative branch, read MAGAs in Congress. They're not standing up to him, and it sets the table for people to distrust everything and for an authoritarian to step up and say, only I have the answer. And I'll just say this. I always want to engage in good faith debates. But over and over and over again on my text line from the conservatives that listen to this show, the things that I hear from them are basically blind faith in everything that Donald Trump and his surrogates say. There's no skepticism. There's no healthy cynicism. It's, he's going to create world peace. He's the greatest thing that ever happened. This man's a genius. Look at all these great things that he's doing. Without any healthy skepticism. I'm not asking these good faith conservatives to turn into Democrats. That's not going to happen. I don't begrudge them their right to have a different opinion. I begrudge the complete lack of any critical thinking on these points. Let's take another caller, Charles from Milwaukee. Good to see you on my caller list, sir. How are you and what you got for us?
Hey, Maggie, you bring up so many good points. It's like, man, a person would just love to be able to, we could talk all day long, but I'll.
Yes, we could, sir.
I won't go to Netanyahu, but I'll go to the thing with the military. So he's claiming, all right, we're sending military in so we can clean up the streets of Chicago. We can clean up the streets of D.C. If I'm correct, and if I'm wrong, correct me. Did he send military to the streets of D.C. where crimes were actually taking place in the rough neighborhoods?
Most accounts are no. I've seen some of those heat maps. Charles, thanks so much for this point. I've seen some of those heat maps of where they deployed National Guard in Washington, D.C., and it is, they do not match up with the high crime areas in Washington, D.C. Like, oops-a-daisy. Maybe it has nothing to do with that. Maybe it's all completely performative. But I wanted to be specific about the lies that are being told by ICE and DHS about the factual circumstances on the ground. On September 12th, ICE agents shot and killed Chicago resident Silverio Villegas Gonzalez in Franklin Park. ICE claimed that Gonzalez was shot after he, quote, seriously injured an ICE agent. The body cam footage shows that the same agent immediately after the encounter described his injuries as, quote, nothing major. On September 30th, some 300 federal agents raided an apartment building in Chicago in the dead of night with a Black Hawk helicopter. I'm not making this up. They rappelled onto the roof like it's freaking Fallujah. Okay? They ransacked apartments. They detained residents seemingly at random, including children and numerous U.S. citizens, including citizen Roderick Johnson, who said this to the Block Club of Chicago. He heard people, quote, dropping onto the roof before FBI agents kicked in his door. He was stuffed inside a van with his neighbor for hours until agents told him that the building was clear. They didn't tell me why I was being detained, Johnson said. They left people's doors open. They left money, firearms, and people's belongings completely unsecured. I'm going to come back with some more facts correcting the record about what ICE and DHS have been saying. If you want to invoke the Insurrection Act, if you want to federalize the National Guard, there had better be the actual facts on the ground to do so. Why is it okay that they're lying? We continue this discussion on the other side. Join me, 855-752-4842. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. If Texas National Guard troops end up in Milwaukee or Madison, will it go as it's been going in Chicago, where at least one man has been shot and killed who is unarmed by ICE agents, after which ICE agents lied about the circumstances, only to have their body cam footage reveal the lie? The lying about the facts is what tells you that this is all baloney. On October 4th, Customs and Border Patrol agents shot an unarmed woman, Marimar Martinez. They claim that she provoked them by ramming their vehicle with her car. Except there's body cam footage that shows the CPB agent ramming into Martinez's vehicle, not the other way around, after which the agent says, "Do something, witch," but with a B. The agent then gets out of the vehicle and shoots Martinez, not with rubber bullets, with a gun. On October 7th, a masked federal agent is caught on camera aiming a weapon at a resident who's supposedly doing and reportedly doing nothing more than documenting his activity. This was reported by Chicago Tribune reporter Laura N. Rodriguez. There have been arrests of local officials, including Illinois' 9th Congressional District Congresswoman Kat Abu Ghazala, who went viral when an ICE agent slammed her to the ground. Daniel Biss, the Evanston mayor and a city alderman were aggressively arrested while trying to advocate inside of a hospital. Journalists have been detained or attacked by federal agents as well. Steve Held was detained. This is a journalist, was detained by agents while covering a protest. That's illegal. A Chicago Sun-Times reporter was tear gassed and pelted with rubber bullets. Again, that's illegal. On Sunday morning, a Chicago CBS News reporter, Azel Rezai, was attacked by an ICE agent who shot a pepper ball into her car from 50 feet away. She was puking for 2 hours. Legal observers, often delineated in the Chicagoland area by their bright neon green hats that read "legal observer," were also attacked by ICE agents. And if you haven't seen this footage, we're going to post it in our show notes from today that you can find at civicmedia.us/shows. Presbyterian minister Daniel Black was standing outside of an ICE facility. He had his arms outstretched to ICE agents on the roof of the building, and he was saying a prayer. In an interview, he said, "I invited them to repentance. I offered an altar call. I invited them to come and receive salvation and be part of the kingdom that is coming." When Black began to lower his arms a few seconds later, the agents fired pepper balls, which are chemical agents that cause respiratory distress and eye irritation, at his head. One struck Black in the head, exploding into a puff of white pepper smoke, which forced him, he fell down to his knees. And the agents continued to fire bullets at the pastor, who is in a black clerical shirt and collar, and laughed at him. They have roughed up elderly women. They have zip-tied small children. They're arresting people who are citizens. They are arresting people who may be here illegally but have no criminal record at all. Their use of chemical agents and rubber bullets was described as a local police chief as arbitrary and indiscriminate. It's been used on crowds doing nothing more than standing around ICE facilities as small as 10 people. On September 27th, several Customs and Border Patrol agents came to a Chicagoland police station and told the police that DHS agents would bring a blank show over the weekend, including that they would use chemical weapons, including tear gas and pepper spray on protesters. Let's be clear about what is happening here. This is not about making Chicago safer. This is not about immigration enforcement. This is state-sponsored mayhem, destruction, and intimidation that is designed to provoke unrest and response from local residents so that Donald Trump may invoke the Insurrection Act. That is what's going on here. This is illegal, unconstitutional violations of civil rights by ICE agents, federal agents, as well as the National Guard, against citizens exercising their First Amendment rights. Let me be clear here. No one can interrupt the execution of a federal law enforcement officer's duties, but you do have a right to yell at them, to protest in their way, and by yelling and being near them, give them the rubber spray, agents with rubber bullets, or, oh my gosh, kill you. Donald Trump is not only pitting the military against citizens, he is pitting the citizens of one state against the other along political lines. That is what the deployment of Texas National Guard in the city of Chicago is. And will they be coming here next? And as we approach the New Kings rally on October 18th, I beg each and every one of you, do not with federal law, remain peaceful. Give them and keep your cameras rolling. Folks, the fight continues tomorrow. Please stay safe with another. I'll be back tomorrow. It will finally be Friday, and another week of the day will have come to an end. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me, but it is always better when we stand together.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.